Hello and welcome to Father Figures, a show about fatherhood, uncommon fathers, fathers of all stripes. Here we talk about the joys and griefs, the risks and rewards of being a dad. I'm your host, Stephen Amaya, and on this episode of Father Figures, we talk with Michael Lamy, who, along with his wife Linda, are the caretakers, the stewards of Greenwood Cemetery. If you've never been there, you're missing something. It's on a gently rolling knoll overlooking Young's River on Highway 202 out past the fairgrounds, and has served a lot of North Coast families since its incorporation in 1891. This interview took place in the Lamy home near the entrance of the cemetery on a very blustery February afternoon. The wind and rain were the perfect setting for the few minutes I spent crossing the graveyard and heading toward the house. I meandered among the headstones. This changed the flavor of the experience. It didn't take much to realize that this is a place full of stories. Michael met me at his front door. We sat down, and we commenced to talking.
Well, I am Michael Lamy, or Mike Lamy, or I even answer to my Chinese name, Hey You. Everybody has the same Chinese name. I was born in Vancouver, Washington. I think that was an afterthought because my parents escaped the Vanport flood in 1948, and I was underwater for another 6 months. The flood was in May, and I was born in December of that year. And then they moved from there to McLaughlin Heights in Vancouver. Both Vanport and McLaughlin Heights were Kaiservilles. They were housing projects for shipyard workers during World War II building ships, and then post-World War II taking them apart again.
So is that what your father did?
Yes, he was a steam fitter at Willamette Iron and Steel. They're on the Willamette River. And he worked putting in the piping in the ships, whether it was the oil pipe supply to the engines or the water supply to the various quarters on the ship. And
so you would say your dad had a 9-to-5 job, or was it?
Well, it was more than that, because he would leave at 5:30 in the morning. It was 30 miles into the shipyard, and the freeway wasn't there yet, so the speed limits were reduced, we'll put it that way. And the cars didn't go as fast, actually. And then it was another 30 miles back home again.
So you didn't see much of him then?
No, he was... We usually got up with him because there on the farm there were chores to do. Go get the cows in, milk the cows, feed them, etc. And he left shortly after we got up. And then he came home in time for dinner. And the last few years after dinner, he would stretch out on the sofa. And we saw him on weekends.
So that was your model?
That was what was modeled, yes.
Yes, yes. Now, did you rebel against...
Rebel, that's a strong word, but I would say that my goal was not to repeat the pattern, if I can put it that way. My dad was in the Army during World War II, and he wasn't deployed overseas, but he was a guard at a German prisoner of war camp. And some of the tactics, if I can put it that way, from both boot camp and his work there as a guard carried over into the family.
Mm-hmm. Discipline-wise or...
Yes.
Attitude-wise?
Yes. Yeah. Early on, he told my mother that he would handle the discipline, that he was raising men, not boys.
Where do you think that came from?
From what I've heard, his father was like that, a strict disciplinarian. One of my uncles told a story that my dad was sent out to do something in the backyard, and he went over to an old lumber pile, and he was gathering snakes, garter snakes, holding them by the tail. Had two hands full when his dad came out to see what he was doing. He saw him coming, and he threw the snakes and ran to do what he had been told. Glanced over his shoulder and saw snakes cascading down his father. But since he was doing what he was told, he escaped punishment, according to my uncle.
Yeah. Okay. Now you grow up.
I'm working on it.
How was your schooling? I mean, you...
I was lazy.
You're lazy.
Yes, and I took the consequences for that laziness. When I was in high school, I wanted to join the track team. And my dad said, you may join the track team when you make the honor roll. So my last 2 years in high school, I was on the honor roll, and I was inducted into the Honor Society, National Honor Society, and took part in track and wrestling.
Yeah. Yeah.
In those 2 years, my dad made it to one track meet.
One track? Oh, yeah, okay. So you decided you weren't going to be like your father.
Right.
Yeah. And how did you begin to pursue this? I mean, let's advance to, did you go to college?
I did, yes.
Yeah, where'd you go?
Went down to Southern Oregon College in Ashland. At that time, the different colleges in Oregon specialized in different areas. So Southern Oregon College was a secondary teaching college. So that's where I went. And that's where I met my sweetie.
Yeah, yeah. Is she in the room?
She is. She's right over there knitting a baby blanket for our great-grandson who's going to be born here shortly.
Wow. Wow, that's great.
So I'm older than I look. Older? No, I look older than I am or something. Anyway, wow. 75. We've got grandchildren and great-grandchildren. But how did I go about it?
Well, you got married and you had kids.
Mm-hmm.
All right. What was those circumstances? What were you trying to have kids? And then one day, she comes running to the door and she says, honey, guess what? What was that experience when you first found out you were going to be a dad?
It was thrilling. It was hang another twig on the family tree.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. But, you were excited about it, I'm sure.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
And apprehensive at all?
Well, maybe a little. Maybe a little bit of, what are we doing? But, we had, that was 2 years after we were married, maybe two and a half, and then another, and then another.
Wait, now, were these planned choices? Or?
Mm-hmm. Yes. We were teaching down in North Bend, Oregon. And then moved to Sandpoint, Idaho, where the second one was born, and then moved to Astoria, Oregon, where the third one was born.
Wow. Okay. So you have three.
Yeah, and they have scattered.
They have scattered. Well, this brings me to the fairly large realm of what it is you're doing. the job you have now.
Well, we came here, when we moved to Sandpoint, Idaho, we moved from public education to Christian education, and then continued in that field when we moved to Astoria, and we wanted to buy a house in the country where we could raise our boys and teach them a good work ethic. And somehow the banks didn't think that we had enough money to buy a house in the country. But then Greenwood Cemetery came available. And for 42 years, I've been the last one on earth to let you down.
Are your kids going to follow in your footsteps? Is somebody going to...
Not if they can help it.
No.
They grew up and they moved away and told me in no uncertain terms, Dad, do not leave us the cemetery in your will.
Yeah. Well, it is a huge responsibility.
It is. It's a stewardship because the cemetery is an outdoor museum and it houses the history of the area. But, well, it's a perpetual care cemetery, which means that you're everlastingly at it.
Yeah. So, your kids are no uncertain terms.
Mm-hmm.
You know it, what were these non... what were these no uncertain terms?
It was point blank. Do not leave us the cemetery in your will.
Yeah. Just you had a family gathering so they could say that.
No, they came individually.
Yeah.
And so I have one who is he started out as a cabinet maker and then a general contractor building houses. I have another who is in education, teaching elementary music and theater in Las Vegas. So they're gone.
How often do they come back?
Well, let's see. The one in Walla Walla keeps saying that he's going to call, and sometimes he does, and sometimes he stops by on his way to somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we see them. The one in Las Vegas is farther away, and his kids are older, and they still sort of hold him in place there.
So what's your relationship with your grandchildren? And now you have a great-grandchild.
We have several great-grandchildren. Like I say, yeah.
Five.
Well, each grandchild is another step into geezerhood. And then you get to the great-grandchildren.
Yes. And you have no choice over that.
Right. Then it's over the hill? What hill? I don't remember any hill.
It's eroded by now.
Yes. It's now a prairie.
Being the steward of this place, I would imagine, I mean, if I did this, it's complete immersion here. And
especially in the wintertime with that heavy rain out there, yes.
Oh, yeah. Has being the steward here changed your mind about death, or does the subject flow more easily from you than it would from most people? Or, you know, I know it's easy to joke about, and it's fun to joke about, and it deserves to be joked about.
But it is a reality, and for those who are dealing with it, it is not funny.
Right.
And yet, at so many of the services out here, you would be amazed at the amount of laughter in the cemetery, laughter at the graveside, as I don't know if it is a coping mechanism or an escape mechanism, but they come up with all of these humorous illustrations from the life of the deceased. And it's laughter instead of weeping.
And the two are very much the same release. Physically, and very often one merges into another. You know, one becomes the other.
Yes, and sometimes they're doing both at the same time, laughing through tears. I don't know. I've conducted graveside services here. We even had a wedding here last year that I conducted.
That's a beautiful place.
It is. The girl who got married was our best weed whacker. She could go through here with a weed eater and clean around the stones getting ready for Memorial Weekend faster than I could.
Yeah. Wow.
Of course, at my age, that's not saying much.
Tell me about your view of death. How can you articulate your feelings about what it means to you?
Well, As I mentioned, I conducted the I've conducted graveside services and I conducted the wedding out here, which means that I put aside one hat and put on my Pastor Mike hat. And that shapes my view of death. It shapes really my view of fatherhood. But unless the Lord comes for us, there's not any of us getting out of here alive.
That's right.
And it is part of life. It is a natural part of life, just like birth is. It's the bookends of life.
But people have very little fear of being born.
And they don't know what they're in for.
Exactly. If they did, they'd say, oh, never mind, I'm going back in. But people fear death. And I'm very curious about what they are fearing specifically. You know, a lot of them fear the manner of death and don't want pain. I think that's a big part.
We have a friend who says, I'm looking forward to the destination, but not the trip.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I just don't want to be there when it happens. Yes. What advice would you have for new fathers?
For new fathers? Well, that's interesting because when I officiate at a wedding, before I do premarital counseling. Mm-hmm. And so the advice is usually packaged into that. And the first word of advice is the best gift that you can give your children is to love their mother. And then that, well, the love that they are to give the mother of their children is the love that our Heavenly Father gives us. And that is a love that consistently and actively seeks the best interest of the object of that love. And then, that then is the love that goes to the children, consistently and actively seeking their best interest. And that has to look beyond the moment. And really, as I mentioned, that's what shapes my view of fatherhood. I'll say this, I'm not a great fan of Hillary Clinton or her book, It Takes a Village. But there is an underlying principle that I do hold closely. And that is that the idea of fatherhood is not limited to our own immediate family, our own children. Because that same sacrificial love we are to give to others outside these walls. Now, we'll say this. Our house has been a safe home for families that are in distress. We had a phone call. Can we come over? Sure. How many of you are there? Nine. And so we had one child sleeping on the love seat, one child sleeping on the sofa, three lined up here on the floor, four upstairs in a bedroom, three of the girls in a queen-size bed and one on the floor beside them. And they would gather around our dining table in there. We have six chairs around it, but we crowded more in, and we had 11 people and 11 plates. And that's just one example. When we were in Sandpoint, Idaho, there was a family in the church. Their doors were open. Their house was open. Teenagers were in and out all hours of the day. And my wife said, I want a home like that. And that's what we have. And so where it is needed, I fill that father figure role, whether they're my kids or not. The ones that come through the door, sometimes they need a hug. Sometimes they just need to talk. They need a listening ear. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they'll need advice. sometimes they'll need either you make the call or I am going to.
Mm-hmm. That's a very fatherly thing. It really is.
It's necessary sometimes. My view. My sweetie and I are one in this. And you go back to creation, and we read where God said, "It is not good, the man alone. I will make a helper to complete him." And so, in spite of the views of this iteration of society and culture, it takes the two halves, the woman and the man. They are different. They fulfill different roles. And together, they form that protective and nurturing unit. Mm-hmm. I am an anachronism. Because I am from a couple of generations back, I don't fit with the modern view. But I view true manhood as the shaping force for fatherhood. And true manhood is, as you say, protective, is honoring, is sheltering, is nurturing. And you look around, I taught for over 40 years, and I saw the effect of absentee fathers, whether they were in the home or not. It used to be appropriate to be discriminating, but it's been twisted to where now it's discriminating against rather than discriminating between. And judging is the same. We evaluate and we reach conclusions.
Yes.
All relationships require maintenance and input. The ability to love sacrificially comes counter to our nature. It's supernatural.
And yet we're called upon to do it.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And it's that builds a positive bond between people. And so whether it's my students over the last over four decades or kids in my studies that come in between study evenings or whatever, call when they need to talk. Mm-hmm. It's the willingness to set aside whatever we're doing to give time, to give of ourselves, to meet a need of somebody else.
I see manifestations of that in older people. I see it rarely in younger people, only because they're busy.
I've seen some artificial divisions of people, the various labels for generations, but one of the things that you'll notice is those who have grown up with an inordinate amount of screen time are isolated in a crowd and tend to be self-focused and self-centered. And whether they are willfully unaware of those around them or aggressively so, it's a generation of isolationists withdrawn from others, focused on their own wants. There's a new generation now that gets a 9-to-5 job and doesn't show up. You mean I'm supposed to be there and work? Well, that was the idea. But I have other things to do. But we have one of the effects of this, I'll say open fatherhood, is that we have had families write their last will and testament, leaving us their children in case of their death while their children were young. We had one student who came in, and our mother wanted to know if we could take her. We were not sure that we could meet her needs. She was a Down's syndrome student. But it turned out to be just the greatest blessing. Yeah. As long as she knew what was going to be going on, no surprise changes, she was fine, and she worked harder than anyone else. Yeah. And let's see, 10 grandchildren and, what, 5 great-grandchildren, more to come. But you know, if you looked on the family tree with all of the ones grafted in, it would be just about to tip over.
Yeah. Well, you have a lot of things to be grateful for.
I do. And some of the ones grafted in are closer than some of the ones that carry the same name.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Right, so we have those in Uganda who are children and grandchildren, and they have a whole lot more melanin than I do. But yeah, we love them just the same.
Well, Michael Lamy, thank you for being on Father Figures. You've been a wonderful guest.
Well, thank you for having me.
Michael's work as a counselor outside his immediate family, what he calls open fatherhood, seems to have an effect among the people who need guidance and aid. He is definitely a fatherly man, in stature, attitude, and with a voice that makes him seem tall and Lincoln-like. Michael, along with his wife Linda, have, it seems to me, carved out an important place in the community. Not only are they the stewards of Greenwood, but their work involves uncovering and maintaining the stories of those who are interred here. They are the history keepers. You might want to check out the cemetery just for the monuments. They're at 91569 Highway 202 in Astoria. Maybe you'll see Michael out working on the grounds. Say hi for me if you do. And check out their website at greenwoodcemeteryastoria.org to get a good idea of the place and the folks behind it, as well as the folks under it. So go visit and soak up a little history. And if you're lucky enough to run into Mr. Lamy, don't hesitate to let him bend your ear for a while. I want to thank Jason Shaw of Audionautics.com for the music on this episode. And please, if you want to drop me a line, send it along to RadioRanchero@gmail.com. So until next time on Father Figures, remember the days may be long, but the years are short. Bye-bye.